You are Locked On Vikings, your daily Minnesota Vikings podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Locked On Vikings. I'm your host, your pal, and the kid you copied off in math class. My name is Luke Braun. You can find me on Twitter at Luke Braun NFL. You can find the show on Twitter at Locked On Vikings. This show is available anywhere you find your favorite podcasts, like Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Himalaya, whatever you like. Or you can ask your smart device to play podcast Locked On Vikings, and it'll take you right to the most recent episode. And today we don't have a lot of news to talk about. There's a couple of random rumors that I don't really feel like getting into, so instead we will just go directly into the prospect of the day. And I'm picking another one that I think Vikings fans have a particularly personal connection to. It's Trevon Diggs, cornerback out of Alabama. The last name is no coincidence. He is the brother, the youngest of the Diggs family. Of course, there's Stephon, who's in the NFL, and then there's Marshawn, who played safety at UAB, and ended up getting a rookie tryout with the Vikings, never ended up making it into the NFL, and Trevon Diggs projects to be like a first or second round cornerback. He's one of many who kind of fall in that area. And the reason I wanted to talk about Trevon Diggs is because there's actually some question going around about him and whether or not the Vikings are interested in him. Charles Davis said on, I think it was on like NFL Network or maybe on a podcast, but he is somebody who has, I mean, you know, some ties inside the league. And he said he'd be really surprised if the Vikings went for Trevon Diggs. Now, again, it's like smoke season, right? And this is the time when you don't want anybody knowing who you're targeting or what you're interested in, because of course that all affects your leverage when it comes to like trading up or down or whatever on draft day. But I thought it was as good an excuse as any to look at Trevon Diggs and say, hey, you know, if it weren't for the last name and all of the kind of fresh wounds that are still going on with Stephon Diggs, would the Vikings be even interested in this cornerback? There have been cornerbacks in the past that aren't really Zimmer's type. I think Greedy Williams falls into that category last year. I talked a lot about, you know, a lot of people were like, oh no, he's not going to pick a lineman. Zimmer's just going to take a cornerback again, because they'd taken Mike Hughes the year before over an offensive lineman, though I would assert that that worked out because they got Brian O'Neill in the second round. But, you know, Greedy was somebody that like wasn't willing to really be like that physical and run support. He wasn't like a Zimmer kind of corners. You know, Zimmer likes somebody that's willing to do the dirty work and isn't going to freelance and all that stuff. And Greedy Williams always seemed like somebody that Mike Zimmer would never be particularly interested in. And sure enough, he took a center with Greedy Williams available on the board. So it's worth, you know, looking at cornerbacks and seeing, okay, you know, what kind of style is this guy? Is he going to be somebody that fits Mike Zimmer? And the answer with Trevon Diggs, awkwardly, is yes. Oh my God, he's such a Zimmer corner, because he has tenacity. And I think what Zimmer looks for, and I think this is what he liked in Xavier Rhodes for so long, is that Xavier Rhodes had fight. I always just go back and think about, you know, the game that he played against Odell Beckham. I think it was 2016, where he got in Beckham's head and he was fighting and clawing and getting pissed off. And he's done, had a couple of these bouts with like Michael Thomas too. And I think that that's something that Zimmer specifically seeks out, not only tolerates, but like wants, you know, as long as you're not going all the way to get flags. And I think that Trevon Diggs has that toughness and that tenacity. He has like a pretty good shove off the line of scrimmage. You know, he'll get in your face when he's playing press, and he plays, you know, he's sticky and he plays and he mirrors well, and he's long and he's physical, and he can use that length to like win at contested catches, you know, and box out these kind of boxy outy Alshon Jeffrey type receivers. You know, he can be successful against that because he has the length for that. I do think that there's something that Zimmer wouldn't love, and it's that he's not particularly tenacious in run support. He's a little, I mean, he's, you know, he'll get in somebody's face off of press, but when it's time for a run play, and a lot of college players are like this, it might be time to, you know, phone it in, or even just like not quite be as aggressive and as willing to hit somebody and get physical, because, eh, you know, I'm a corner, I just got to kind of set the edge. And that's a knock that a lot of corners go under, and I don't think it takes him out of the like first, second round conversations that he's been in, but I do think that has, you know, I think that sticks in Zimmer's mind. Personally, I don't really care much about it in terms of like if I were the GM of the Vikings, because the point of a corner is not to be a run support guy. But we know that Zimmer values that a lot more than like I personally do, and that's fine. But I think that there are a couple other knocks. There's a lot of technique stuff. He gets a little flat-footed sometimes. He can kind of get caught, and sometimes he has to use that length to get contested catches. And of course, I mean, even though he played in like the SEC and, you know, playing against guys like AJ Brown and stuff, but of course, any little issue that shows up in college tape, but like doesn't hurt. I mean, that is the kind of thing that's going to get exacerbated at the NFL level. And so I'm sure that Trevon Diggs is going to be somebody that comes in and takes a little bit to kind of get his feet under him. And maybe that's not what the Vikings need. That said, it seems like in a lot of the mocks that I've been looking at, he's been available in like the second round. Currently on Grinding the Mocks, which is a tool I'll link in the show notes, and you can kind of look at where all your favorite players are lining up right now. He's lining up at like pick 31, pick 32, and kind of, you know, there's a lot of mocks that have him in the second round, and a lot of mocks that have him, you know, getting picked around where the Vikings pick. And there are plenty of mocks that have him going to the Vikings, even though they just traded away his brother. So I think if the Vikings aren't interested in him, I think that like from an X's and O's standpoint, it's defensible, though I would definitely disagree with it. That said, there's lots of other corners out there they could be interested in, like Christian Fulton and Jeff Gladney, and we'll talk about those guys someday. But, you know, if they do pass up on Trevon Diggs and he's like easily the best corner on the board and they were doing it because it's like personal, that I would disagree pretty hard with, and I'd be pretty disappointed about that. And it does sound like there is something like some sour grapes kind of going on in the organization, and I really dislike that. But I don't think it will lead them to make some indefensible decision, because when they do draft a corner, and I'm sure they're going to at some point high in the draft, they'll take some cornerback. When they do, there probably will be another defensible option. And so if you wanted to engage this decision explicitly on football terms, you would be able to. I don't think you should, because if they are making it personal, like you do have to factor that in and kind of, you know, you like that can be a critique of the way that they do it, even if they end up at the right decision after all. You know, they pick Christian Fulton, who I think is a better corner over Trevon Diggs. Like I would be okay with that, but I would be less okay with it, you know, if we're looking at this thing in August and Holton Hill is an anointed starter because we passed on Trevon Diggs for personal reasons and took like a guard instead. I would really, really disagree with that. So I don't know. Reading the tea leaves, it sounds like there's something to that, and that's disappointing, but I don't think it will lead them to do something like completely and utterly indefensible. It's bad process, but hopefully we can be insulated from the bad results that that would produce. So for the rest of the show here, we're going to talk about something that I've been kicking around a lot. I've mentioned it a few times in the other podcasts recently, so it might be something that is a little redundant, but I'm okay with that because I really want to like get this topic out there and kind of like explain my thought process on this, because I think it's a good heuristic by which to evaluate certain positions and positional importance and kind of how to parse out the differences in positional importance. There's a lot of like wins above replacement work that's been done, but also stability, and it's like difficult to parse that out. And I have a really nice heuristic that I think like delineates all that stuff really nicely, and that's kind of what I want to talk about today. So all of that's going to come up when we come back. It'll get a little more ethereal today. I hope you guys are in a philosophical mood. On Thanksgiving Day in 1998, the Minnesota Vikings played the Dallas Cowboys, and there was quite a bit of drama surrounding this game. You may remember it. Of course, that was Randy Moss's rookie year, and in the draft that year, Randy Moss was pretty convinced that the Dallas Cowboys were going to select him with the 8th overall pick. But much to his chagrin, they drafted Greg Ellis, a defensive end out of North Carolina, and Randy Moss, due to various character concerns and a pretty well-told and well-worn story, he fell all the way to the Vikings at the 21st overall pick. So this Thanksgiving game was Randy Moss's chance at revenge. And for a variety of reasons, this game goes down in the history books as one of the better revenge games of all time. For one, Randy Moss was prolific. He got 3 catches for 3 touchdowns and 163 yards. That's an average of over 50 yards a play. That's 3 game-breaking plays in what turned out to be a blowout win for the Vikings. Add to that the mythos of the revenge game and the emerging swagger and personality that was Randy Moss, the primetime atmosphere, and just the coming out party it was, and it's one of the most memorable Vikings games of all time, if you ask me. But I always think it's interesting that this game got the legacy that it did, because after all, as big of a performance as it was for Randy Moss, it was 3 catches. And there are, 50, 60 plays that go on over a given offensive football game, and 3 of them end up telling the entire story. Now, of course, 163 yards, 3 big long touchdowns, like, of course, those 3 plays should be the most prominently etched into our minds. But that's kind of the thing that got me thinking about this idea of how do we remember wide receivers? How do we evaluate wide receivers, right? If you don't do anything for an entire game, but you catch three balls for three long touchdowns, you go down in the history books. And I don't have a problem with that at all. I think that's actually a pretty poignant way to describe the way that we view wide receivers and skill positions and playmakers in football. I think of some of the other sports and the people who are like historic, right? You think about LeBron James or Kobe Bryant and the legacy moments that they've had. You know, you think about like when Kobe scored 80 points. You think of, you know, scoring LeBron James having 45 points and shooting 73% from the floor in game six of the NBA finals to secure his first championship. You know, these are consistent, dominant, every single moment of that game was about Kobe or about LeBron or about whatever. And with football, it's so different, right? I mean, half the plays of any given football game, I mean, take the best player of all time, Tom Brady or whoever you want to say it is. Tom Brady's not on the field for half the games that he's playing. That's, I think, something that's like relatively unique to football. Even in baseball, it's kind of about consistency, right? You think of like Barry Bonds. Barry Bonds did it with quantity, and he did it with like consistent greatness. But when we think of football, a lot of the things we think about are singular moments. I mean, we all know who David Tyree is, and that's because of one play. But it's not all about that, because if you think of like the best corners ever, I think of like Darrell Revis, right? And you could think about Revis Island and the impact that he had and the way that he warped the field. And that's something he had to execute every single play. I don't think Randy Moss needed to do that, or Jerry Rice, or whoever, Marvin Harrison, whatever. I don't think that those guys needed to be on and successful every single play. You could take it to the extreme and say, hey, what if in that Dallas game, they shut Randy Moss down for the other however many plays it was? That game is still etched into all of our memory, and Mike Zimmer's memory even. He was the D-backs coach on Dallas at the time, so he's somebody that like remembers that game in his nightmares. And you know, you shut a guy down for all but three plays, you're remembered for the three plays. And I think that that speaks to a dichotomy that exists in football. And I think that it helps to explain a lot of things that are difficult to reconcile that come with analytics. So there's a lot of talk about like positional importance. And I think that we should address it at this particular time, because this is draft time. And I get a question all the time. Hey, what position should the Vikings prioritize? That question comes up all the time in my mentions and stuff like Score North and athletic mailbags, everything. What position should the Vikings prioritize? And I don't think the draft tends to manifest itself that way, right? Because you could say, well, they should always prioritize quarterback. Everyone should prioritize quarterback, right? It's the most important position. There's a bajillion, gallons of evidence that support this. Well, you should always, always, always prioritize quarterback. But sure enough, you know, you're going to have maybe five quarterbacks go in the first round or whatever. That's what it was a couple years ago. And everybody else is going to take like tackles and linebackers and stuff. And part of that is because, you know, certain teams have a need, right? If you are the Kansas City Chiefs, you have Pat Mahomes, you don't necessarily need to go like reach out and say, well, I mean, but like quarterback's important, so let's pick Jordan Love. Like, no, you have Pat Mahomes. You're not going to get the same equity out of that pick as like maybe the Colts would. But I think part of it is, you know, with the actual talent available, right? If the big four tackles, I think it's Andrew Thomas, Mekhi Becton, Tristan Wirfs, and Jedrick Willis, if those guys are gone and somebody's picking 16th overall and they think that's too high for Josh Jones, even if tackle is like their biggest need, they might go a different direction with a player they think is better, like one of the wide receivers or whatever. Because a lot of teams will say, hey, you know, that position is a need, but I want a player who's better at football, and we'll figure out how to, you know, smooth over the needs after it's all said and done. And so there is kind of a dichotomy of best player available versus need, and maybe we'll talk about that someday, although I think it's a little less relevant to the Vikings this year because they have a large quantity of needs. So it's pretty likely that the best player available is going to address a need, and you don't really have to decide between the two. But I think it's also something where, you know, teams just aren't going to pick Justin Herbert over Isaiah Simmons. That's just not how it's going to work, because they just aren't going to value like positional importance. But I think that there's also something to the way that we evaluate certain positions, and that is going to kind of help us ordering these guys. And I talked a little bit about it yesterday when I was talking about Tyler Johnson and Justin Jefferson and like playmaking ability and stuff. And I think that's something that's really important with wide receivers. I think of the most consistent wide receivers I could possibly think of, you know, back in the day. I think of somebody like Marvin Harrison speaks to this to me. I think he's somebody that was just like the steadiest Eddie ever. And he's probably on most people's lists below Randy Moss in terms of the greatest of all time. And for all the things that Randy Moss was, reliable was kind of the thing that he very famously was not. If people said he would like alligator arm it, although I think that's BS, you know, he would get in trouble and he would, you know, dog routes or whatever. There was all these narratives about Randy Moss, but in spite of that, most people still put Randy Moss above Marvin Harrison. I don't even think that's a homer take. And that's because wide receiver is a position that it's about what you did and not what you didn't do. And I think conversely, something like offensive tackle. Think about like Joe Thomas, right? He was famous for starting every game, for being crazy consistent. Think about, you know, Darrell Revis. And sure, there's like Deion Sanderses out there who are like these crazy playmakers that were like known for it. But I think by and large, when we're talking about corners that are good, I mean, the best corner in the league, I want to say, is like Stephon Gilmore. Maybe that's a terrible take. I'm forgetting somebody, but let's go with that for now, right? And Stephon Gilmore shut down. And somebody like Richard Sherman just doesn't get targeted all the time. And they're shutting down parts of the field and you never hear their name, you know, and with like offensive linemen say, I didn't hear his name. That's probably a good thing because it's about consistency. It's about being 60% good. I mean, if you could be a C+ every single snap, you probably had a phenomenal game. And like PFF grades are actually constructed this way when it comes to offensive linemen and to other similarly like reactive positions where every play you don't give up a pressure, you even if it's like a messy play or it's like a quote unquote expected where like maybe, you know, they rushed four and you were the guy that didn't have an assignment and you get a zero grade on it because it's just like neutral, whatever, you didn't do anything, those plays actually count as a positive for offensive linemen because there is a consistency factor. And if you go through a whole game and you have only like quote-unquote expected plays, you're actually going to have a good grade on that game. And they do that on purpose because for an offensive lineman, if you played okay on every snap but you didn't give up any pressures, you had a good game, and they want their grades to reflect that. So this is why I'm calling it like the proactive versus reactive dichotomy. And I'll get into some of the implications of this and how we can actually apply it to like help us be more informed watchers of football in just a second. So stick around for that. Okay, so here's the dichotomy that I'm trying to draw. It's proactive positions versus reactive positions. And I can even run down the list and kind of say which is which, but I think you could kind of get it that there are people in football who try to make things happen, and there are people in football who try to prevent things from happening. And evaluating this can be a really helpful way to kind of organize yourself around a flurry of information. So there's a pretty big debate, and this is probably a debate for another day to actually weigh in on, but of like pass rush versus coverage, right? And most analytics that's been done on this supports that coverage is king. Coverage is more important than pass rush. Essentially that, the play where somebody gets an interception is better than a sack, and a play where somebody gets a pass breakup is better than a pressure, and so on and so forth. And there's just like more impact on your coverage than there is on your pass rush. But the kicker to that is that pass rush is way more predictable and way more stable. So the idea that, well, you should always figure out your secondary before you figure out your defensive line, or you should spend more on your secondary than your defensive line, I think is a better way to put on it, is kind of flawed. And the same analytics people like Eric Eager admits this, and he's like been a champion of the pass rush versus coverage, all the war work, wins above replacement work that he's done. He's been like a champion of this. And so he like even admits like, yeah, but like coverage is less stable. So if you wanted to like be more sure that you're going to get a return on investment, you might want to sacrifice a little bit of ceiling and a little bit of that efficiency and actually spend on pass rush. And so that's why you can kind of justify like paying Aaron Donald to go to like the extreme case, or, you know, paying a big contract to somebody like Danielle Hunter. I think sometimes they get a little bit inside themselves, but that's kind of why I say, hey, you know, when somebody like extends a defensive lineman to a big contract or does something like, you know, pay Chris Jones the franchise tag and, you know, have a big amount of money tied up in your defensive line, it can work out because you're more sure about what you're going to get. Even though coverage, you could get more, but you're not as sure that you're going to get that more because coverage is a little unstable. And it's like, well, how does this work though? Like, aren't there just corners that are good? Like, what do you mean it's not stable? Like, aren't there guys like Richard Sherman out there? And aren't there guys, I mean, I would have said like Xavier Rhodes, but I guess that's an example of something that he kind of just fell away suddenly and it, like suddenly just sucked after being like an all-world corner for forever. And, you know, there's guys out there that are like just genuinely, I mean, there's guys like Eli Apple out there or guys like Ronald Darby that just like are constantly villainized because they just are like stably the quality of player that they are. And so how do we reconcile this kind of thing? And I think that classifying corner as a reactive position is something that can help us think about cornerback play. What are you doing? You're trying to prevent something from happening. You're trying to prevent the wide receiver from catching the ball or prevent him from getting open, or in run, you're trying to, you know, go make a tackle and prevent them from getting yards. Whereas the person opposite you, the wide receiver, is trying to make something happen, right? They're trying to be a playmaker and go carry something out. If the team ends up in the same place that they were before, you know, from one play to after the play, the cornerback won. I think you could apply the same thing to offensive linemen, right? Or at least in pass blocking offensive linemen and defensive linemen, conversely, too. You know, if the team is in the same place where they were before, you know, before the block and after the blocking has concluded, the offensive lineman probably won, right? Because the defensive lineman's job is to generate pressure, to generate sacks, to generate penetration and disruption. And if they didn't generate anything, the offensive lineman won. So the offensive lineman is the reactive position, and that's why we judge them on the basis of consistency. And the proactive position is the pass rusher. And so the principle right off the bat is that proactive is more stable than reactive. And that kind of makes sense, right? Because like, if you are defending a passing game, who has more control over whether or not a pass is complete? The quarterback, the wide receiver, or the corner? I would say the corner is last on that list. And so, of course, it's unstable because sometimes you get beat because Dak Prescott threw a perfect pass and Amari Cooper dragged his toes on the sideline. That happened to the Vikings a whole bunch in their Sunday night tilt in 2019. And, you know, conversely, you could get completely burned in coverage and the quarterback could sail it way long and totally ruin the play. And it didn't matter that you got beat. And so that leads to instability. That means that, you know, I guess my hypothesis is always predicated on the idea that good players just like remain good and players don't just suddenly become bad at football for no reason, but more that the metrics on which we judge them, which are usually results oriented, right? Did the guy catch the ball? Did he not? Did it get yards? Did it not? You know, did they make the tackle? Did they miss the tackle, etc.? A bunch of different measuring sticks on, you know, on which to do that. But largely the results of a play sometimes are just out of your control. And so even if you were very, very good in a game, you could have just gotten beat on unbelievable, indefensible contested catches or a perfect back shoulder throw or something. And that can cause cornerback play to look really, really bad, even if the guy didn't play poorly at all. And I think this leads to a whole bunch of disconnects between coaches, you know, and then they're like standing. I think this happened a little bit with Rhodes, though he also had like some pretty bad play, so I don't want to turn this into a defend Rhodes party. And so, you know, when we're looking at draft prospects and we're looking at guys like, you know, at cornerback, and shoot, we'll go back to Trevon Diggs, because I actually think this is kind of a knock against him, is that he tries to be a playmaker and sometimes he gets himself in trouble, you know, try to jump a route and then get beat on a double move, stuff like that. And that's something that most defensive coordinators get really, really annoyed by, because you would rather have somebody be sticky and in good man coverage and get, you know, one pass breakup and that's it for a whole game than have them get, you know, one interception and give up two touchdowns. It's like the Marcus Peters thing, right? Like Marcus Peters gave up a ton of touchdowns and a ton of interceptions, and it was super polarizing if he was good or not, because it's really difficult to parse like playmaking ability from what is usually a reactive position. It was easy to evaluate Darrelle Revis. It was easy to evaluate somebody like Richard Sherman or Desmond Trufant in his heyday. And hey, look at David Tyree, right? He's etched in football history forever. And of course, this is a huge fluke, so it's not exactly like pointing to a trend, but I do think that it points to the way that we should be evaluating wide receivers, because I think most people would like to have a David Tyree moment stapled to their franchise. David Tyree didn't do anything in the league before or after that helmet catch, but he had one play, and that is all it took. Do we remember who that cornerback was that got beat? Probably not off the top of your head, unless you're a Giants or a Patriots fan or a football historian. We don't think of that as the play where the defensive back messed up and let David Tyree get it. You know, we think of it even like Raheem Moore, who got beat on that famous long touchdown to, I want to say it was Jacoby Jones against Baltimore in that like crazy divisional round game. I want to say it was 2012 on their Super Bowl run. We still know it was Jacoby Jones and Joe Flacco making those passes, and we only remember Raheem Moore because he made such a boneheaded decision about it, and that's how we have to, you know, remember you. But for the most part, do we remember who Santonio Holmes beat in the Super Bowl to toe drag that catch on the sideline to win it over the Cardinals? Do we remember who screwed up the read on the Philly special to get that Nick Foles touchdown right before the half to give Philly their first Super Bowl? No, and that's because wide receivers are proactive, and the wide receiver is the one in control of that situation. The cornerback can do what they can to prevent it, and when they do, it's rightfully praised, and when they do consistently, it's rightfully praised more than that. But wide receivers are proactive, and we should judge them based on what they can do, not necessarily what they can't do. And that was my point yesterday about like Justin Jefferson, where there's a little bit of judgment going on about like, yeah, but he like can't be a burner, but he can. What he can do is impressive enough to make him a first-round receiver, and that's why I'm like kind of a fan of his. Compare that to somebody like Tyler Johnson, who's going to fall to the fourth round because what he can do is fairly limited. And I know I said I was going to do it at the beginning of this segment, so I'll do it right now. So just going down like the list of positions, I think quarterback is a proactive position, obviously. Running back is a little more interesting. I'm actually going to circle back to that one later. I think all offensive linemen, when they're pass blocking, they're reactive. When they're run blocking, they're proactive. I think there's a little more nuance to that than you would initially think, right? Because when you're run blocking, you're trying to move somebody off a spot. And I would say that the linebackers and defensive linemen on run plays are the ones being reactive and trying to not let themselves get blown off the ball so that they can go make a tackle. I think that, like, on run plays, offensive linemen are the ones most in control of that play. Of course, I've talked about it a bunch. Wide receivers are proactive. Tight ends, I think, fall in that same proactive category because they're, like, also pass catchers. On defense, of course, defensive linemen, exact opposite of offensive linemen. When it's a pass play, they're proactive. They're trying to generate pressure. They're trying to be disruptive. They're trying to make something happen that otherwise wouldn't if they stood still. And in terms of run plays, they are the reactive position because they're waiting to see what the offensive line will do and they're reacting to it. I think linebackers are the same thing. If they ever pass rush or blitz or whatever, they're proactive, but they're reactive otherwise. And of course, coverage, safeties, cornerbacks are all reactive positions. But I kind of want to circle back to running back real quick because I think that one's a little interesting. You would say like, oh, you know, that's a proactive position, right? They're trying to make plays. They're trying to go get yards. But I actually think that they're a little bit more reactive than we think. And I think that that's something that helps me explain away the running backs don't matter narrative. With, and you know, reconcile it with like playmakers like Saquon Barkley and Dalvin Cook, who are like super, super dynamic and fun to watch. But I think that because running back is usually at the mercy of what the offensive lineman does, and there's lots of data, and honestly, it's like pretty intuitive, right? You can't run through a hole that isn't opened for you, and if a giant hole is opened for you, it's pretty easy to run through. And there's very few moments where there's a lot of high leverage yardage on the line that's up to whether or not the running back was good. They can pick the right hole, they're going to be fine. And I think that dynamic leads to a bunch of stuff, like with the wins above replacement analysis. You know, you look at a given run play, and if the offensive linemen were good on it, but the running back wasn't, that play probably was still successful, and vice versa. If the running back was great, but the lineman screwed up, yeah, he broke two tackles and he got a negative yard, right? Like, that's the kind of thing that points, in my opinion, points toward offensive linemen having way more control over a run play than a running back does. So I would almost call running back a reactive position, at least on run plays. I think, you know, any pass catcher is proactive, but on a run play, and I guess screen plays count as like run plays for the purposes of this, because they're more like a run where you got blockers and whatever, I digress. The point is, on a run play, I think that a running back is usually reacting to what the offensive line did. And so it's not like a heads bumping together, you know, rivalry, like offensive and defensive line being kind of like converse of each other. But I think that what the running back does depends so much and is so like almost parasitically dependent on what the offensive line does that I can classify it as a more reactive position than we would intuitively think. And I think that that, to me, was like a kind of light bulb moment that helped me reconcile the undeniably huge pile of data that tells me running backs don't matter with the opposite thing that my eyes see of running backs breaking tackles and making things happen and all of these examples of, no, see, look, those are yards that Dalvin Cook got and other running backs wouldn't have. How can you tell me this doesn't matter? I think thinking about running back as a reactive position really helped me reconcile it. And that's part of the reason I like this heuristic quite a bit. And it can help us look at draft prospects, look for consistency in reactive positions, and look for, you know, playmaking ability and you know, explosiveness and all of those skills when it comes to proactive positions like wide receiver and, you know, edge rusher and stuff. So that is my little musing about proactive versus reactive positions. I'm going to come back to this a whole bunch throughout the draft, so I wanted to get this out of the way before we really dove into a lot of the prospects. I will see you all tomorrow. Hopefully we'll have some news to talk about. I really want to see where this Vikings team is going to end up. I still don't think that they resemble what they will look like come draft day, and if they do, that's a giant failure. But hopefully they don't. So you can, of course, find me on Twitter at LukeBraunNFL. The show is on Twitter at LockedOnVikings. The show is available anywhere you find your favorite podcasts, or you can ask your smart device to play podcasts. Locked On Vikings. I will see you all tomorrow, and as always, Skol.